Fans, for the past 2 weeks, you have been reading about the bad break I got. Yet today I consider myself the luckiest man on the face of the earth. I have been in ballparks for 17 years and have never received anything but kindness and encouragement from you fans. Look at these grand men. Which of you wouldn't consider it the highlight of his career just to associate with them for even one day? Sure, I'm lucky. Who wouldn't consider it an honor to have known Jacob Rupert? Also, the builder of baseball's greatest empire, Ed Barrow. To have spent 6 years with that wonderful little fellow, Miller Huggins. To have spent 9 years with that outstanding leader, that smart student of psychology, the best manager in baseball today, Joe McCarthy. Sure, I'm lucky. When the New York Giants, a team you would give your right arm to beat, and vice versa, sends you a gift, that's something. When everybody, down to the groundskeeper and those boys in white coats, remember you with trophies, that's something. When you have a mother-in-law who takes sides with you and squabbles with her own daughter, that's something. When you have a father and a mother who work all their lives so you can have an education and build your body, it's a blessing. When you have a wife who has been a tower of strength and shown more courage than you dreamed existed, that's the finest I know. So I close in saying that I may have had a tough break, but I have an awful lot to live for. This is Kurt Benrud for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is designed for a print and visually impaired audience. And welcome to another edition of Did You Know?
This is Para Tolleson. That speech was from Lou Gehrig, July 4, 1939. You've never heard anything like it in sports, and it may be, at least to me, one of the reasons that baseball is America's national pastime. So welcome to Baseball 2011. The season officially begins March 31st.
This is Bob Martin. In 1903, a want ad appeared in a New York newspaper looking for a boy who had never seen a baseball game. The Washington Post commented on the ad by saying that if such a boy could be found, he would be fit only to crawl off somewhere and die and be the subject of some bugologist's experiment. Thus is the game of baseball embedded in the American culture.
As we start a new baseball season in 2011, Did You Know is going to dedicate this program to the seriousness and the lunacy of baseball, especially old-time baseball. We're going to start in 1951 with the pennant stretch in the National League. On August 11th, the Brooklyn Dodgers were leading the New York Giants by 13.5 games. Amazingly, the Giants won 16 in a row and were able to tie the Dodgers and force a three-game playoff. It was to be a one game at one city and then two at the opposing city. The Dodgers won the coin toss and elected to play the first game at home. The Giants won 3-1 at Ebbets Field. The second game went to the Dodgers, 10-0 at the Polo Grounds. Now it was time for the final, third game from the Polo Grounds. Sal Magley was pitching for the Giants against Don Newcomb. The score was 4-1, Dodgers going into the bottom of the ninth.
Giants shortstop Alvin Dark singled. With Gil Hodges playing close to the bag, Don Mueller placed a single through the gap and Dark went to third. Monty Irwin, who led the National League with 121 RBIs, popped out. Whitey Lockman fell with a double down the left field line, scoring Dark and moving Irwin to third. Irwin slid awkwardly and broke his ankle and was replaced by Clint Hartung. Chuck Dressen came to the mound to replace Don Newcomb. Both Carl Erskine and Ralph Branca were in the bullpen warming up. Dressen chose Branca. With the score 4-2 and Hartung at third and Lockman at second, Bobby Thompson came to the plate. Russ Hodges was at the microphone.
Bobby Thompson up there swinging. He's had two out of three, a single and a double. And Bobby Cox is playing him right on the third base line. One out. Last of the ninth. Branca pitches. Bobby Thompson takes a strike. Called in the inside corner. Bobby hitting at 292. He's had a single and a double, and he drove in the Giants' run with a long fly to center. Brooklyn leads at 4-2. Hartung down the line at third, not taking any chances. Lockman with not too big a lead at second. But he'll be running like the wind if Thompson hits one. Branca throws. There's a long drive. It's going to be, I believe, the Giants win the pennant. 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 Bobby Thompson hits into the lower deck of the left field stand. The Giants win the pennant, and they're going crazy.
Did you know who was waiting on the deck circle to bat after Bobby Thompson? A young fellow named Willie Mays. Willie made the center stage spotlight in the 1954 World Series against Cleveland. It was Game 1 in the Polo Grounds, eighth inning, with the score tied 2-2. Cleveland had men at first and second with no one out. Vic Wirtz hit a deep drive to center field. Willie Mays turned and ran back, catching the ball over his shoulder, seemingly without ever looking back to look for the ball. That catch was 450 feet from home plate. He whirled and made a perfect throw back to the infield to keep Larry Doby from scoring. The Giants went on to win the game and the series in four straight. For years, whenever anybody talked about the catch in baseball, that was the play.
Our program today is going to look at the game of baseball, not the business. And we're going to concentrate on the old days when just about anything could and did happen, with players whose names you might not have heard for a long time, if ever.
Did you know when the first baseball game was ever played? Well, I don't know the exact year, but one bunch of guys came out of one cave carrying their clubs, and another bunch of guys came out of another cave with their clubs. Somebody picked up a rock and said, "Play ball."
It might not have been that long ago, but let's play ball. How's this for a start? In 1902, the Old Town team of the Northern Maine League was playing at Millencoot, where the river flowed right along the outfield. Horace Newenham was playing right field for Old Town when Barrington, the Millencoot's heaviest hitter, came to bat. He drove the ball over Newenham's head and plop into the river. Barrington slowed way down and strutted around the bases. Meanwhile, Newenham came to the riverbank, dove in, and swam out to the ball. He stuck the ball in his mouth and swam back to shore and then made a perfect throw to the third baseman, who tagged out the strutting Barrington. You won't see that in Yankee Stadium.
How about this? On July 14, 1903, it was a hot day in Minnesota when teams from Benson and Wilmar faced each other. By the second game, the players were exhausted, and then the game went into extra innings. Thielman, Wilmer's star pitcher, came to bat in the 10th. He swung listlessly and, behold, got a single. O'Toole fell with a deep drive, and Thielman ran as best he could. Rounding second, he started to slow down and then collapsed right on top of third. O'Toole came up to him, and knowing that if he passed Thielman, he would be out, he picked up Thielman and carried him across his shoulder to home plate. He dipped Thielman's foot down to touch home and then stepped on home himself, just ahead of the throw. A doctor came out to the stands and announced that Thielman had died at third base. A run had been scored by a dead man.
But if you thought that could never happen again, you'd be wrong. Up in New Brunswick, when the Chatham Stars were playing the University of St. Joseph, a man named O'Hara collapsed on third, and a teammate carried him across home plate, just like O'Toole had done.
A rock on the infield, good or bad?
Bad. It could bounce anywhere.
That's why some players, shortstops especially, from countries that don't have nice playing fields, don't try to take a ground ball directly in front of them, but circle it to keep them getting hit in the face.
Normally true, but in 1905, William Griffith was playing first base for Salt Lake City when a ground ball hit a rock on the field and bounced right into his glove. Easy out. Not wanting to take another chance, he went over and picked up the little rock, intending to throw it away. Something caught his eye, and he stuck it in his pocket. He came back later that night and collected a bunch of stones. What caught his eye was free gold. He enlisted the help of a couple of friends and bought the park. They called the mine First Base, and the first shaft hit ore at 33 feet. Here's one early player that became rich from playing baseball.
Usually a team is limited to 9 players at a time. But in 1908, in Indiana, Pakoda was playing Evansville and got some unexpected help. Evansville was ahead when a Pakoda player hit a long ball out into the cornfield. The outfielder ran into the field and came out even faster, holding the ball outstretched with one hand and his nose with the other. The ball hit a skunk, who retaliated. A wind blew in from the cornfield for the rest of the game. The Pakoda boys were used to the smell. Evansville wasn't, and three of their players just got sick. Pocota came back and won 7-6. Six runs scored, and Evansville still got skunked.
In 1889, the superintendent of the New York State Hospital for the Insane came up with an idea to help patients that didn't seem to be interested in anything.
He took them to a baseball game?
Oh, better than that. He made up a team and played. Result? 1-11, lost 3, and tied 1. How's that for a dream team?
In 1890, Bill Lang of Chicago once won a ball game for his club just by lying on the ground. With a man on first, Lang hit a single to right field, but overran the base, and he had to dive back in. Meanwhile, the first baseman had dropped the ball, and while trying to find it, the Chicago runner kept on running, while Bill lay draped across first base. The fielder decided that the ball was under Bill, but by the time he tugged Bill off the ball, the runner had scored.
In 1890, Crazy Schmidt was pitching for Macon, Georgia. After one game, he got into an altercation with the fan and was charged with throwing a brick at the man. When Schmidt got into court, he pleaded not guilty. He told the judge, "You know of wonderful control and I exhibit on the mound. Well, there stands the plaintiff. If I had thrown a brick at him, I would have hit him and killed him. Him sitting there proves I didn't throw a brick at him. Not guilty."
Players were always trying to think of ways to get back at a spitball pitcher. One day in 1912, Philadelphia was coming in to play Pittsburgh, who had a spitball pitcher by the name of O'Toole. Philly first baseman Fred Luderus came up with a plan. Since O'Toole always hid the baseball behind his glove and then licked the ball, Luderus came equipped with a tube of powerful liniment, and every time he touched the ball, he rubbed it up with liniment. It wasn't long before O'Toole's tongue was burning, and he had to leave the game. When Pittsburgh discovered what had happened, they lodged a protest. The Philly manager came to Luderus' defense, claiming he ordered the action. He said, "You never know what kind of germs were being spread around, and they had a right to protect their health."
In 1890, Joe Kelly was playing outfield for Baltimore. A high wind had hit the city the night before and had blown down the outfield fence. Repairmen had done their best. The fence was up, but slanted at a 45-degree angle. During the game, a ball was knocked over Kelly's head. Kelly raced back to the wall. The ball was still going to be over his head, so he kept running right up the wall, caught the ball, and went right over the fence. First time a ball hit over the fence was an out instead of a home run.
Speaking of fences, in 1916 in Brooklyn, the Phillies had come to town. The score was tied in the bottom of the 11th when George Cutshaw, the Dodgers' second baseman, hit a line shot down the right field line. The ball should have hit the wall and bounced back, but it didn't. There was a slight incline in the fence, and the ball hit the bottom of the fence and rolled right on up, paused at the top, and dropped over. No ground rule doubles in those days. Home run.
What's important enough to delay a game? Well, on May 29, 1896, John Kalacki was playing second base for Patterson in a game against Newark. When he came to the bench after the top of the first inning, he was told he was wanted at the side of the grandstand. What he found was a constable or a warrant for his arrest. Also, there was the complaining party, Miss Kate Cameron. John was told that he either would marry the girl or rot in jail. After some discussion, a justice of the peace was found in the stands, marriage performed, and John returned to the game.
Back in the 1880s, the rules for the game were a little different. Outfielders didn't have to come all the way to the dugout between innings if they were not coming to bat. Often they'd sit by the fence and visit with the fans. Such was the case with Abner Dalrymple of Chicago. Late in the season of 1885, Chicago was in a tight race with Philadelphia, and the game went into extra innings. So many extra that it got dark. These are the days before lights. Chicago scored in the top of the inning, and Dalrymple took his place on the outfield for the bottom half. With things so dark, you could hardly see. The batter, seemingly with the eyes of an owl, connected and sent a long fly over Dalrymple's head. Abner ran to the fence, jumped high in the air, and stuck the ball in his pocket and trotted off the field. The umpire called him out, and the game was over. Nobody could prove anything, but some thought that Abner was faking it. Years later, the fan that Abner was visiting with said, "Sure, Abner saw that ball. So did I. It was 10 feet over his head."
Only in the old days. In 1903, Rube Waddell refused to sign a new contract. Connie Mack brought him in to ask why. Was it the money? Rube said, no, the money was fine. It seems his roommate, Schreckengost, had a habit of eating crackers in bed. These were the days when ball players shared a bed. The cracker crumbs in the bed were driving him crazy. Waddell got a clause in his contract forbidding his roommate from eating crackers in bed, and Rube signed.
Jermaine Schaefer was a second baseman for Detroit, and about as daffy as they come. He and his roommate got into an argument about whether or not the earth revolved. Germany said it didn't, and he could prove it, and the bet was made. Before going to bed, Germany went into the bathroom and filled a bathtub. The next morning, he took his roommate into the bathroom, pointed at the still, full tub, and said, you see, if the earth moved, the water would have spilled. The roommate replied, well, I hadn't thought of that. You win.
Carl Sawyer was an infield for Washington and also a fair to Midland acrobat. In one game, Carl was on first when the batter hit a single. Carl was waved to third. Bad decision. The ball was there long before Carl. Instead of crashing into the third baseman, Carl leapt into the air and did a perfect flip over the baseman's head and landed on the bag. The umpire yelled, you're out. An argument ensued, and the umpire explained, you left the base, and that ain't legal.
Back in 1885, Chattanooga was playing Macon when their right fielder got sick and had to be removed from the game. The only extra player they had was a spare catcher named Bullis. Now, Bullis was okay behind the plate, but was at a total loss in the outfield. Luckily, there was little activity in right field until the eighth inning when Macon had men on second and third with two outs. The batter hit a long drive to right. Bullis ran in, then ran out. He got to the fence and looked up, right into the sun. Everybody in the ballpark knew where the ball was, everybody except Bullis. It hit him right on the top of the head and bounced into the stands for the winning home run.
That's the way the ball bounces, so they say. And if we're following the bouncing ball, it looks like a segue into how the major league teams got their names.
The New York Giants, originally called the Gothams, they were renamed the Giants in 1889 by manager Jim Metrick. The Brooklyn Dodgers, they were named after the fans who had to dodge the trolley cars on the way to getting into the stadium. The Cincinnati Reds, originally called the Red Stockings. In St. Louis, in 1899, the St. Louis Browns were renamed the Perfectos with a change of sock color. In Chicago, Chicago's first professional team was called the White Stockings. In the 1880s, when the team began to sell off its more experienced players, the press referred to them as the Colts and then named the Cubs. The Boston Braves. James Gaffney, originally the president of the Boston Club in 1911, had been a member of the corrupt Tammany Hall group. Tammany came from Tamamin, a Delaware Valley Indian tribe. The group adopted the Indian headdress as its emblem and called themselves Braves. Philadelphia. Originally, they were called the Quakers, later changed to the Philadelphies, shortened to the Phillies. And Washington, and obviously the Senators. The New York Yankees, originally known as the Highlanders. In 1904, their name was changed to the Yanks, or Yankees, because the name better fit the headlines. In Boston, they originally a member of the American League in 01, had no official name. They were called the Bostons, or the Americans. In 1907, they switched the team colors to red and became the Red Sox. In Baltimore, named after the state bird. In Detroit, the team had been called the Wolverines, and sometimes the Tigers. When they joined the American League, they borrowed the name officially from the Michigan 425th National Guard Infantry Unit, the Tigers. In Chicago, in 1900, Charlie Comiskey moved the St. Paul Saints to the south side of Chicago, and they took had been the old nickname, the White Sox. In Cleveland, there was a legend they were named after an old Indian ball player named Louis Sulalexis. That seems to be an urban legend. They were probably named after the miracle Boston Braves, who had swept the World Series in 1914. Philadelphia. They were named the Philadelphia Athletic Club, later shortened to the A's. Finally, Pittsburgh Pirates, so named because they were accused of stealing players from all the other clubs. They liked it, kept it.
right back to some more old-time stories. Back in the days when the umpire usually stationed himself right behind the pitcher, Matty Fitzgerald was calling the game between two semi-pro teams in Chicago. To save time, he stashed an extra supply of baseballs inside his shirt. As he bent over to watch the pitch, one ball rolled onto the pitcher's mound. The batter slashed the pitched ball right back at the pitcher, striking the spare ball dropped by the umpire, sending them in two different directions. One ball was fielded by the shortstop, the other by the second baseman, and both threw to first. Fred McNichols, the first baseman, caught one with his right hand, the other with his left. It could have been a ticklish situation, but the umpire called him out. He said, "Both balls beat you there. No argument."
Back in the 1880s, Chris Van Dye was the president of the old St. Louis Browns. One day he walked into the clubhouse and found out that some of the equipment had been damaged. Immediately he called a team meeting, where he expressed his displeasure, so much so that he offered a $100 reward for information as to who was responsible. After a silence, Arlie Latham stood up and announced that he knew who was guilty, but he wanted his $100 before he would tell. After he got his money, he confessed that he had been the one responsible. Chris let out a roar and promptly fined him $50 and stomped out. Nobody was getting the better of old Chris.
Well, back in 1895, Rochester was playing at Springfield in Massachusetts. Springfield had a commanding lead when, in the seventh inning, O'Brien hit a ball that landed in the river running by, and it floated away. Though Rochester was still way behind, that was the hit that won the game. In the eighth inning, one of the Springfield players met the ball squarely and split the ball in half. The rules stated that the home team had to supply the baseballs. No ball was offered, and the umpire forfeited the game to Rochester.
Dave Altier of the old Chicago White Sox used to amuse himself with practical jokes, which were bound to catch up with him sometime. They did one day in Cleveland. Dave got a base on balls. On the next pitch, Dave lowered his head and started toward second. He heard the crack of the bat, but didn't know where the ball went. It went straight to the first baseman, who caught the ball and stepped on the bag for a double play. Nick Altrock, who was coaching at third, saw the play and started yelling for Dave to slide. Slide, which he did. The first baseman now got into the act and heaved the ball into left field, with Altrock now yelling for Dave to get up and run. He came into third with another magnificent slide, where the left fielder, now into the mood, pitched the ball high over third and rolling toward the stands. Again, Dave is on his way home when the third baseman retrieves the ball and fires to home. The catcher misses the tag by 2 feet. The umpire yells, "You're out!" Now begins an argument wherein Dave calls into question the umpire's parentage, stating that the catcher never touched him. The umpire returned the compliment of parentage and told him, "You were out at first base."
You'd have a thought that Dave would have learned his lesson, but he didn't. Sometime later, Dave was at bat with a 3-2 count and let a sweeping curveball go by which the umpire called strike three. Statements of parentage and ascendancy were brought to bear while Dave ignored the fact that the ball had gotten away from the catcher. He had ample time to get to first base easily if he wasn't intent on berating the umpire. The screams from his teammates were not encouragement for his argument, as he learned when he got back to the dugout.
On August 22, 1885, in Lawrence, Kansas, a baseball game was held to raise money for a monument honoring Ulysses Grant. One team was composed of county officials, the other of local businessmen. The players ranged in age from 40 to 70. Here's the box score. The registrar of deeds was running out a two-base hit when he fell and broke his arm. The county clerk broke his shoulder. The deputy sheriff got several teeth knocked out by a batted ball. A prominent grocer dislocated his knee. A druggist broke 2 fingers. The county officials won 51 to 41. The take at the gate was $150. The doctor's bills came to $180.
One day out in Memphis, a fan was given the opportunity of umpiring a game. He did pretty well into the fifth inning. With one out, a player from Atlanta hit a long drive. The outfielder took off running, stretched out, and made a beautiful over-the-shoulder catch, went to the ground, rolled over twice, and came up holding the ball. The umpire yelled, "Batter's out, and the side is out." That's the best catch I've ever seen, and it's worth 2 outs instead of just one.
How's this for a ninth-inning home run? In 1898, Minneapolis was playing at St. Paul. St. Paul was up by two runs in the ninth. But Minneapolis was coming back. They had two men on with two out. The batter sent a deep drive to center field. In this park, it was a short distance, so an exceptionally high fence had been installed, and a lot of baseballs bounced off that fence. This was going to be one of them. The outfielder got into position to take the bounce. The catcher threw off his mask, waiting for the throw. The ball hit the fence and stuck. Someone had driven a long nail through the fence, and the ball hit the nail dead center and stayed.
In 1897, Judd Smith was the third baseman for Syracuse and one of the most superstitious of a breed of superstitious people who played the game. He once went into a bad slump and went for weeks without getting a hit. He tried all kinds of jinx breakers, but nothing helped. Then one day Providence came to town, and Judd watched Bassett, the Providence third baseman, get double and a triple on his first two times at the plate. He was going to watch Bassett closely to find the answer to his slump. What he saw was that as Bassett came to the plate, he reached into his hip pocket, pulled out a plug of tobacco, and took a big chaw. There was the answer. The next day, Judd came to the park with a plug of tobacco. In the first inning, he took a big chaw and stepped to the plate and got a clean single to center field. As he made the turn at first, he slightly stumbled. Now, Judd was not a user of tobacco, so with the slight stumble, he swallowed the chew. Within 15 minutes, he was so sick he had to leave the game. After that, he figured, no matter how long the slump lasted, there would be no more chaws of tobacco.
Rowdyism had always been a problem in the early days of baseball. So in 1909, Miss Frank Church, the wife of Chicago's Cubs manager, came up with a solution. If only more women would forsake their bridge, whist, and pink tea, soft cushions and kimonos, and head out to the ballpark to cheer on their local boys, they would clear up the vulgar language, put an end to rowdyism, with the result that there would be less work for the doctors.
Little did Mrs. Church realize, but in 1905, a young woman, Miss Amanda Clement, became an umpire for a professional league in northwestern Iowa and South Dakota. She received some 60 offers of marriage from men in her league alone, but declined, saying that she could do more good for the game and the nation by uplifting the characters of professional players who do not know how to behave. She became nationally famous, but abandoned umpiring after a couple of years and went back to college to become a teacher of physical culture.
In 1908, in St. Paul, William Beasley appeared in court suing his wife Teresa Beasley for divorce on the grounds of desertion. He testified that he had gone away from home on a business trip, and when he returned, he found a note from his wife that she had joined an all-girls baseball team and was never coming back. Divorce granted.
Well, those last stories might have led the way to the answer of rowdyism. It wasn't women at the ballpark or even a woman behind the plate. It was women in baseball. With the help of the World War, that's what happened from 1943 to 1954. The idea of an all-women's league came about as an attempt to maintain an interest in the game while so many teams were declining because of young men going off to war. The first league was owned entirely by chewing gum mongol Philip Wrigley and was called the All-American Girls Professional Softball League.
There was an immediate problem with the name because the owners didn't want this new league to be confused with the many women's softball teams that were already in existence. The name was changed to the All-American Girls Baseball League, and then, in 1949-50, to the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League. And finally, from 1951 to 1954, the American Girls Baseball League.
Even those names could have been misleading because the game was not baseball as it has been played. It was a hybrid. A 12-inch ball was used, the same size as a softball. Pitching was underhand. They did pitch from a mound, but it was only 40 feet from home plate, and the bases were 65 feet apart and 9 players to a team. Over the years of the league's operation, the rules were changing until the mound was moved back to 60 feet, the bases were 85 feet apart, overhand pitching was allowed, and the ball was reduced to 9.5 inches, the standard hardball size.
Uniforms were also an innovation. The women wore a belted short-sleeved tunic dress, knee stockings with a skirt that was to be no more than 6 inches above the knee. This last rule was mostly ignored in the interest of running and fielding. During spring training, the girls were required to attend even charm school classes from Rubenstein's. Each player was instructed in proper etiquette for every situation. Personal hygiene, mannerism, and dress code were presented. As a part of the rules of conduct, no short hair was allowed, no smoking or drinking in public, and lipstick was required at all times. The league had a theme song that was written by Pepper Perry Davis and Nalda Bird Phillips, and made famous when it was used in the 1992 film A League of Their Own with Tom Hanks, Rosie O'Donnell, Gina Davis, and Madonna. It went, "Batter up, hear the call, the time has come for one and all to play ball. We are the members of the All-American League. We come from cities near and far. We've Canadians, Irishmen, and Swedes. We're all for one and one for all. We're all Americans. Each girl stands, her head so proudly high, her motto, do or die. She's not the one to use or need an alibi. Our chaperones are not too soft. They're not too tough. Our managers are on the ball. We've gotten a president who really knows his stuff. We're all for one. We're one for all. We're all Americans."
The league folded in 1954 as Major League Baseball was back to full strength. It ended an era of genteelness in the national pastime. I wonder if women's baseball would have survived if the ladies had been allowed to fight, swear, spit, and scratch.
Here comes the bouncing ball back to rowdyism, and worse. This article appeared in Sporting Life in 1906, and the editor swore it was true. On a June day in 1763, a small garrison of English soldiers occupied a stockade on Mackinac Island. The soldiers were enjoying a lazy afternoon when a group of Indians came out of the woods. It was soon apparent that they were not intent on attacking the fort, but playing a game in the clearing. The game involved hitting a ball with a stick and then a lot of running around. The soldiers became interested, and after a while the Indians motioned for the soldiers to come down and join them, which they did. The Indians said the name of the game was Bagataway. The play continued for about half an hour, and one of the Indians hit a well-placed shot inside the fortress walls. The Indian outfielders let out a hoop and ran inside the fort as if to fetch the ball. The attack was so sudden and unexpected that only one soldier who hid in a cave was left alive.
One July day in 1896, Saginaw was playing at Washington, Pennsylvania. Beside the fans and the teams also present that day was a Saginaw mascot, a bulldog named Saginaw, who belonged to the manager of the Saginaw team, a Mr. Black. Late in the game, with Pennsylvania leading and Mr. Black fretting, Saginaw had a man on first. The next batter hit a high foul, which was caught by the Washington catcher, close to the stands. The runner saw that the catcher had his back to the field, so tagged up, and tried to take second. The catcher was alert and fired the ball to second baseman for a double play. Mr. Black was irate. He couldn't be mad at the runner for trying to advance, nor at the batter for fouling out, not at the umpire for making the correct call. Instead, he viewed the catcher as a culprit, grabbed his dog, he pointed to the catcher and hollered, "Sick him!" The bulldog promptly attacked the catcher, ripping his stocking from knee to ankle. The catcher started off running with the dog in hot pursuit. They got as far as second base, at which point the dog apparently figured that he had done his duty, proudly trotted back to the Saginaw dugout. Apparently, no one had heard Mr. Black sick his dog on the poor catcher, so when all returned to their places, the umpire simply said, "It is my opinion that the baseball field is not a proper place for a dog."
William Madden of Louisville was a great baseball fan, but his job as a railroad engineer made it impossible for him to go to many games. However, the track went right by the ball field, so he could at least, well, glimpse the inside of the park as the train went past. On a July afternoon in 1912, such a time occurred, and what he saw that day was a ball hit far out, going over the fence and coming right for his engine. Madden leaned out of the cab and caught the ball barehanded. The crowd cheered. Madden tooted his whistle and traveled on down the line.
In 1896, in a game between Cincinnati and Cleveland, the great Cy Young was pitching. Irwin was on third, and Burke was on first for Cincinnati as Young pitched. Burke broke for second, and the throw beat him easily, but the second baseman, Childs, muffed the ball. Irwin scored, and Burke headed for third. Now, instead of picking up the ball, Childs grabbed Burke and tossed him in the air. Burke responded by punching Childs in the face, and the crowd came pouring out onto the field. Luckily, enough policemen were in attendance to stop the riot. Remember the earlier story about rowdyism? More than 100 policemen were standard for baseball games in those days.
In 1887, the Detroit Tigers were barnstorming and came to play in Sturgis. A local fellow came up to pitching ace Charlie Getson and told him that a friend had made a bet that he wouldn't score a run. He offered to split it with Getson if he'd throw an easy one up to the plate so he could hit a home run. Charlie said he could let no busher hit a home run off him, but he would throw a ball over the catcher's head after two strikes. All the fellow had to do was swing and then start running while the catcher chased the ball. Charlie collected his $5 in advance and the game began. When the fellow came to bat, two strikes and then a sweeping curveball, swing and a miss. Kerplunk into the catcher's glove, strike three. Afterwards, the fellow went up to Getson and asked, "What happened?" Charlie answered, "Was that you up there? I didn't recognize you with the uniform on." And he walked away with $5 in his pocket.
Here's a story about one fan who forgot it was just a game. In 1904, a man named Laird was the number one fan of the Pittsburgh Pirates. He was at every home game, cheering them on with glorious ideas for a great season. Even when the Pittsburgh club began to slide, his enthusiasm did not. That is, up to the time when everyone knew that this was not going to be even a good season, let alone a great one. Laird became despondent. On September 19th, the paper carried a story of his devotion, concluding with a brief statement that Mr. Laird had been removed to the insane department of the Mercy County Almhouse.
How about another train story? In 1910, in Harrison, New Jersey, the train tracks didn't run close to the outfield. They ran through the outfield. One day a train was leaving the Lackawanna station when a fly ball was hit deep. The engineer saw the outfielder and blew his whistle. The outfielder stopped and then watched as the ball disappeared right down the smokestack. The bases were loaded at the time, and the umpire ruled home run and all four runs count. Despite the protests, the umpire said that the smokestack was in fair territory when the ball dropped into it.
There may have been a lot of rowdyism in the early days of baseball, but regardless of what team you played for and how hot the rivalry, there was some things around which all players rallied together. And that was romance. One such situation occurred in 1894 in West Virginia when an infielder from Elizabeth team, one Pouch Rathbone, loved and was loved by Miss Pink Riddle. The major obstacle to their romance was Papa Riddle, who thoroughly disapproved of Mr. Rathbone and his profession, yet he loved the game of baseball. Numerous attempts were made by Pouch to ferry his loved one away, always foiled by either Papa Riddle and a gun, or by Papa Riddle's bulldog. Then come one afternoon when the family turned out for a ball game. So furious was the contest that when the seventh inning came, Papa Riddle didn't notice that Pouch had disappeared from the Elizabeth bench. Or did he think it was a problem when Pink yoo-hooed to a girlfriend and excused herself to go visit with a female companion? With the coach waiting, Pouch and Pink sped off to awaiting justice of the peace while players from both teams joined together to argue and delay while the couple made their escape to wedded bliss. Upon completion of their subterfuge, the newlyweds returned to Elizabeth where they were met at the courthouse by hundreds of fans who offered their congratulations and took part in the party. The bride's parent relented. They now had a baseball player in the family.
Well, around the turn of the century, whenever a pitcher developed arm trouble, he made tracks to a mechanic in Youngstown, Ohio, a mechanic by the name of Bonesetter Reese. It all started in 1899 when a pitcher named Cuppy developed severe arm troubles, and his arm hurt every time he tried to throw the ball. He went to several specialists, but nothing helped. Then a friend told him about the Youngstown mechanic who had studied about arms, just because he was interested, and set broken bones after hours. With no other hope available, Cuppy went to see Bonesetter Reese. Reese took Cuppy's arm, moved it around a few times, felt up and down, and told him, "You got a couple of cords out of place." He gave the arm a couple of twists, and then told Cuppy he could pitch the next day. He did, with no pain at all. From then on, Bonesetter Reese was the man to see if you had arm problems.
The newspaper man, H.L. Mencken, once printed an article where he tried to explain the origin of the term Charlie Horse, the leg pain. Mencken offered two possible answers. He said that the phrase could be traced back to 1891 and either referred to an old Baltimore pitcher, Charlie Esper, who walked like a lame horse, or it might have come from Sioux City, Iowa, where a local groundskeeper used an old horse whose name was Charlie. But a better answer may be traced back to the early 1880s and coined by a ball player named Joe Quest. It seems that Chicago team had a day off, so some of the boys decided to go to the races. There was a hot tip on a horse named Charlie, so the boys pulled a bet, all except Joe Quest. And for his refusal, he took a lot of ribbing. When the race started, Charlie broke to the lead and held his position to the stretch when suddenly he came up lame and finished dead last. Now it was Joe's turn to needle. The next day, Joe was coaching a third when Gore got a single. On the next pitch, Gore broke for second, but hit a soft spot and twisted a muscle and was easily thrown out. At which point, Joe started in again, just like your old Charlie horse. The name stuck and then spread to other teams, and now everyone knew what a Charlie horse is. But not all of them remembered where it came from.
Never turn around suddenly. An outfielder named King once did. He was running to catch a fly ball. When he got to where he figured the ball would be, he stopped quickly and spun around, and promptly broke both of his kneecaps. The rest of his baseball career he spent as an umpire.
In 1887, a game was held in Philadelphia between old railroad men who had been crippled in train accidents. Those with an arm missing were called snorkies, and those who were missing a leg were called hoppers. The snorkies won, 15-4, but the interesting part of the game was a contested play at first base. A snorky hit the ball and was running to first. The shortstop fielded the ball and threw to first. The ball was wide, so the first baseman stretched out, caught the ball, and then touched first with his crutch. The umpire called him out. The umpire ruled that indeed the crutch was part of the hopper first baseman.
Old-time pitchers had lots of ideas on how to get batters out. John Clarkson was one of them. One day, Clarkson went out and bought himself a big silver buckle. His idea was that the sun would reflect off his buckle and dazzle the opposing hitter so they couldn't see the ball. He soon discovered that there was no reflection until he positioned the buckle just right. So he developed a set of gyrations that would put an exotic dancer to shame. He would go into a set of swivels and hip movements until he got the right reflection, and then came the pitch. After batters started to complain, the umpires deprived Clarkson of his silver buckle, but it was still some time after that before he lost his wiggles.
Many years ago, a reporter was aboard a New York subway when the train made a stop near the New Jersey ferries. The entire baseball team got on board in full uniform. Each man found a seat, plopped down, and promptly went to sleep. He didn't know that baseball players were the sleepiest people in the world. In 1890, a New York sports writer composed an essay on the subject, raising the question as to why a bald paper's life was so soporific. He wrote that they were exceptionally temperate in their use of stimulants, but each of them spent an average of 10 hours a day sleeping, and even at that, while on the trains, they would doze off.
It is necessary to go clear to California to find a record of a baseball game in which no one argued with the umpire. Around 1906, Cedarville was playing Alturas. Their rivalry was notorious, and past meetings had been accompanied by plenty of fistfighting. Just before the game started, the umpire called both teams out to him, and he said, "You fellows are going to play baseball, and that's it. No monkey business, no fighting, and no hollering at me. Get that straight. First bird that steps out of line will have to deal with me, and I mean business." The umpire was the sheriff of the county, and he had his pockets full of blackjacks and a gun stuck in his waistband. It was the most peaceable baseball game the people of Alturas ever witnessed.
On the other side, the people of Brooklyn were amazed one day when umpire Hank O'Day put up a string of abuse from ball player Bill Dolan. It was a doubleheader, and all during the first game, Dolan yelled, screamed, swore, threw dirt, and once even stepped on the umpire's foot. O'Day just stood there as if nothing was happening. Later on, the story came out that before the game, Dolan went up to O'Day and asked him what he would do if someone called him as so-and-so and what and what. O'Day replied that he would throw the so-and-so or what-and-what out of the game and out of the stadium. Dolan said that would be just fine because he wanted to get out of the game early to go back to the track. There was some good ponies running. So O'Day just ignored the abuse, and as the day wore on, Dolan realized that he wasn't going to get to those races. So he just quieted down during the second game and never said a word.
That's the kind of experience that would make the day long and age a ball player. And with that in mind, I've got a did you know for you. Who was the oldest player to be on a major league roster?
Did you know I can answer that? But to have it be more than just a name, I have to back up a little. And that little is 1860, when on September 28th, at Elysian Fields in Hoboken, New Jersey, Weeksfield of New York defeated the Union Club 11-0.
Well, what happened there that was so different?
Both teams were all black.
And did you know the first black player to appear in the major leagues may not have been Jackie Robinson? In 1884, Moses Fleetwood, also listed as Fleet Walker, and his brother Welday, played for the Toledo Blue Stockings of the American Association, which was in the Major League American Association for 1 year. In 1886, Frank Grant joined the Buffalo Bisons of the International League, and several other players joined the International League the following season. But 1888 was the last year blacks were allowed to play in the majors of high minors until Jackie Robinson.
The first professional black team was formed in 1885, the Babylon Panthers from Babylon, New York. Shortly thereafter, an all-black league was formed by the Florida newspaper. In 1887, a second league was started with teams from Baltimore, New York, Boston, Philadelphia, Louisville, and Pittsburgh. Both of these leagues folded for financial reasons, but some limited success was in the future. In 1910, Andrew Foster began planning for an all-black league. The big difference in his plan was that every club would also be black-owned. In 1920, the Negro National League was founded with eight teams: Chicago American Giants, Chicago Giants, Cuban Stars, Dayton Marcos, Detroit Stars, Indianapolis ABCs, Kansas City Monarchs, and the St. Louis Giants.
During the ensuing years, the future of the all-black leagues was always in doubt. Teams started and teams folded. The Southern League had fair success, but even they had problems. The thing that made the difference was the coming of the war, when the standard teams, major and minor, were depleted by men going into the service. With blacks starting to migrate north to fill factory jobs, Negro baseball thrived fairly well until the post-war era, when baseball was eventually integrated.
When Happy Chandler became baseball commissioner in 1944, he began to push for integration of the game. In 1945, the Brooklyn Dodgers announced the signing of Jackie Robinson. Later that year, they also signed Roy Campanella, Don Newcomb, John Wright, and Roy Parfloe. Robinson played his first game for Brooklyn on April 15, 1947. Most everyone knows about Jackie Robinson in the National League, but did you know who was the first black player of the American League? Making his debut on July 5, 1947, for the Cleveland Indians, Larry Doby.
When Ted Williams was inducted into the Hall of Fame in 1966, he made a strong plea for inclusion of players from the Negro Leagues into the Hall. Finally, in 1971, players from the Negro Leagues began to have their rightful places in the Hall of Fame. Satchel Paige, Cool Papa Bell, Oscar Charleston, Martin DeHigo, Joss Gibson, Monty Irvin, Judy Johnson, Buck Leonard, and John Henry Lloyd. Others were added over the years. One in 2006 was an executive of the old Negro League, Effa Manley. Why is this selection important? Effa was the first woman inducted into the Hall of Fame. Now we come to the answer to the question of who was the oldest player to ever be on a Major League roster. At the suggestion of Dave Winfield, a special draft was held to rectify the exclusion of players because of race. Each team selected one ball player. The New York Yankees selected Emilio Navarro, age 102. In 1911, the Detroit Tigers were warned to beware of the likes of Mary Pitford and her kind. Manager Huey Jennings advised his players that picture shows were injurious to their eyesight and should be avoided. So, speaking of show business and baseball, we now present the greatest baseball sketch ever written and performed by Abbott and Costello.
Look, Kurt, if you're the coach, you must know all the players.
I certainly do.
Well, you know I've never met the guys, so you'll have to tell me their names, and then I'll know who's playing on the team.
Oh, I'll tell you their names. Let's see. We have on the bags, who's on first, what's on second, I don't know is on third.
Okay, that's what I want to find out.
I say, who's on first, what's on second, I don't know is on third.
Are you the manager?
Yes.
You're going to be the coach, too?
Yes.
And you don't know the fellow's names?
Well, I should.
Well, then who's on first?
Yes.
I mean the fellow's name.
Who?
The guy on first.
Who?
The first baseman.
Who?
The guy playing.
Who is on first?
I'm asking you who's on first.
That's the man's name. name.
That's whose name?
Yes.
Well, go ahead and tell me.
That's it.
That's who?
Yes.
Look, you got a first baseman.
Certainly.
Who's playing first?
That's right.
When you pay off the first baseman every month, who gets the money?
Every dollar of it.
All I'm trying to find out is the fella's name on first base.
Who?
The guy that gets it.
That's it.
Who gets the money?
He does. Every dollar. Sometimes his wife comes down and collects it.
Whose wife?
Yes. What's wrong with that?
Look, all I want to know is when you sign up the first baseman, how does he sign his name?
Who?
The guy.
Who?
How does he sign?
That's how he signs it.
Who?
Yes.
All I'm trying to find out is what's the guy's name on first base.
No, what is on second base?
I'm not asking you who's on second.
Who's on first?
One base at a time.
Well, don't change the players around.
I'm not changing nobody.
Take it easy, buddy.
I'm only asking you who's the guy on first base.
That's right.
Okay.
All right.
What's the guy's name on first base?
No, what is on second?
I'm not asking you who's on second.
Who's on first?
I don't know.
He's on third. We're not talking about him.
Now, how did I get on third base?
Why, you mentioned his name.
If I mentioned the third baseman's name, who did I say is playing third?
No, who's playing first?
What's on first?
What's on second?
I don't know.
He's on third.
Then I go back on third again. Will you just say on third base and don't go off?
All right. What do you want to know?
Now, who's playing on third base?
Why do you insist on putting who on third base?
What am I putting on third?
No, what is on second?
You don't want who on second.
No, who is on first?
I don't know.
Third base.
Look, you got outfield?
Yes.
That left fielder's name?
Why?
I just thought I'd ask you.
Well, I just thought I'd tell you.
Then tell me who's playing left field.
Who's playing first?
I'm not. Stay out of the infield. I want to know what the guy's name in left field.
No, what is on second?
I'm not asking you who's on second.
Who's on first?
I don't know.
Third base.
The left fielder's name.
Why?
Because.
No, he's center field.
Look, you got a pitcher on this team?
Sure.
The pitcher's name?
Tomorrow.
You don't want to tell me today.
I'm telling you now.
Then go ahead.
Tomorrow.
What time?
What time what?
What time tomorrow are you going to tell me who's pitching?
Now listen, who is not pitching?
I'll break your arm. You say who's on first. I want to know what's the pitcher's name.
What's on second?
I don't know.
Third base.
Got a catcher?
Certainly.
The catcher's name.
Today.
Today and tomorrow's pitching.
Now you've got it.
All we got is a couple of days on the team. You know I'm a catcher too.
So they tell me.
I get behind the plate to do some fancy catching. Tomorrow's pitching on my team, and a heavy hitter gets up. Now the heavy hitter bunts the ball. When he bunts the ball, me, being a good catcher and all, I'm going to throw the guy out at first base. So I pick up the ball and throw to who?
Now that's the first thing you've said right.
I don't even know what I'm talking about.
That's all you have to do.
It's to throw the ball to first base.
Yes.
Now who's got it?
Naturally.
Look, if I throw the ball to first base, somebody's got to get it. Now, who has it?
Naturally.
Who?
Naturally.
Naturally?
Naturally.
So I pick up the ball and throw it to naturally.
No, you don't. You throw the ball to who?
Naturally.
That's different.
That's what I said.
You're not saying it.
I throw the ball to naturally.
You throw the ball to who?
Naturally.
That's it.
That's what I said.
You ask me.
I throw the ball to who?
Naturally.
Now you ask me.
You throw the ball to who?
Naturally.
That's it.
Same as you. Same as you. I throw the ball to who? Whoever it is drops the ball and guy runs a second. Who picks up the ball and throws it to what? What throws it to? I don't know. I don't know. Throws it back tomorrow. Triple play. Another guy gets up and hits a long fly ball to because why? I don't know. He's on third and I don't give a darn.
What?
I said I don't give a darn.
Oh, that's our shortstop.
How else to end this program on baseball than with a famous story by Ernest Lawrence Thayer, Casey at the bat. It looked extremely rocky for the Mudville Nine that day. The score stood 4-6 with but one inning left to play. And so when Cooney died at first and Burroughs did the same, a pallor wreathed the features of the patrons of the game. A straggling few got up to go, leaving there the rest, with that hope which springs eternal within the human breast. For they thought if only Casey could get a whack at that, they'd put up even money with Casey at the bat. But Flynn preceded Casey, and likewise so did Blake. And the former was a pudding, and the latter was a fake. So when that stricken multitude a death-like silence sat, for there seemed but little chance of Casey's getting to the bat. But Flynn let drive a single to the wonderment of all, and that much-despised Blakely tore the cover off the ball. And when the dust had lifted, and they saw what had occurred, there was Blakely safe at second, and Flynn a-huggin' third. Then from the gladdened multitude went up a joyous yell. It bounded from the mountaintop and rattled in the dell. It struck upon the hillside and rebounded on the flat, for Casey, mighty Casey, was advancing to the bat. There was ease in Casey's manner as he stepped into his place. There was pride in Casey's bearing and a smile on Casey's face. And when responding to the cheers, he lightly doffed his hat. No stranger in the crowd could doubt 'Twas Casey at the bat. 10,000 eyes were on him as he rubbed his hands with dirt. 5,000 tongues applauded as he wiped them on his shirt. And while the writhing pitcher ground the ball into his hip, defiance gleamed from Casey's eye, a sneer curled Casey's lip. And now the leather-covered sphere came hurling through the air, and Casey stood a-watching it in haughty grandeur there. Close by the sturdy batsman, the ball unheeded sped. "That ain't my style," said Casey. "Strike one," the umpire said. From the bleachers, black with people, there rose a sudden roar, like the beating of a storm waves on a stern and distant shore. "Kill him! Kill the umpire!" shouted someone from the stand, and it's likely they'd have done it had not Casey raised his hand. With a smile of Christian charity, great Casey's visage shone. He stilled the rising tumult, and he bade the game go on. He signaled to the pitcher, and again the spheroid flew, but Casey still ignored it, and the umpire said, "Strike two." "Fraud!" yelled the maddened thousands, and the echo answered, "Fraud!" But one scornful look from Casey in the audience was awed. They saw his face grow stern and cold, they saw his muscles strain, and they knew that Casey would not let that ball go by again. The sneer is gone from Casey's lip, his teeth are clenched with hate. He pounds with cruel violence his bat upon the plate. And now the pitcher holds the ball, and now he lets it go. And now the air is shattered by the force of Casey's blow. Oh, somewhere in this favored land the sun is shining bright. The band is playing somewhere, and somewhere hearts are light. And somewhere men are laughing, and somewhere children shout. But there is no joy in Mudville. Mighty Casey has struck out.
This is Kurt Benrud for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Thank you for tuning in to this edition of Did You Know? This has been our welcome to the 2011 baseball season.
This is Par Tolson. This program has been designed for a print and visually impaired audience. If you know of someone who is print and visually impaired, tell them that they can get a sub-channel receiver to hear the special programming available by calling the station.
Or if you are able to help support the programming and services of the Triangle Reading Service, just call the station at 832-5138.
That's 919-832-5138. Your help is necessary for us to continue with all of our programs.
And this is Bob Martin. You may also hear our broadcast over the internet by going to the Triangle Radio Reading Service website and click on the Listen Now prompt on the navigation bar. Did You Know? Airs on Thursdays at 9 p.m., Saturdays at noon, and Sunday evenings at 8. And for the Cub fans, wait until next year.
Let's end this show with an Ernie Harwell remembrance.
Take me out to the ball game. Take me out to the crowd. Buy me some peanuts and Cracker Jacks. I don't care if I never get back for his root. Root, root for the home team. If they don't win, it's a shame. For it's one, two, three strikes, you're out at the old ball game.
Play ball!